This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. This show is brought to you by the Docs for Patient Care Foundation, which is a tax-deductible, not-for-profit charity, which is doctor-led, but it's all about you, our patients. I'm a board member of this great foundation, and we're dedicated to fighting for healthcare freedom in America, something all of us have taken for granted but is quickly slipping away. We fight for the doctor-patient relationship, something that's intrinsic to good healthcare, but it's being undermined and eroded and potentially could be lost altogether. The Docs for Patient Care Foundation website is currently under construction, and it'll be ready to launch in about 2 weeks. And that's when you, our listeners, can become involved in this great organization and help us fight for you. I'm your host, Dr. Hal Schurz, and each week we invite you into the lounge to listen to the kinds of private conversations that doctors have with each other all across the country. These discussions are often about complex patients and difficult medical decisions that doctors have to make, but more likely, they're about things that you think about all the time that affect you and your family and their health care. Things like the high cost of insurance, problems finding a doctor, difficulty getting insurance coverage because of your expensive or chronic medical problems. You'll gain some insight in how doctors think about problems that affect our business and our ability to do our job. And that's the business of taking care of all of you. And finally, we'll try to debunk the myths that circulate about medicine and about doctors and arm you with information, which is a very powerful tool to fight back against those who try to misinform the public in order to further their agenda, which is to control your health care and the decisions that you need to make regarding it, and take it away from you and your family. Medicare is a hot button for everyone who deals with healthcare delivery and policy and politics. And Medicare, not to be confused with its poor cousin Medicaid, is the federal government-run healthcare system for senior citizens managed by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS. This agency is part of the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS. There are about 50 million Medicare beneficiaries, and its annual budget is about $600 billion, making it the second largest entitlement after Social Security. It's also a political football, and it's part of every discussion involving federal elections. What you need to understand, and what we will get into in just a minute, is that Medicare is going broke. And how quickly this is happening is a subject of debate, and we'll discuss this. But doctors are dropping out of the system like flies. It's getting to be a tremendous problem. And it's leaving senior citizens without a doctor to take care of them, and we'll explore that issue as well. Joining me today is my good friend, Dr. Richard Armstrong. He's a general surgeon in Newberry, Michigan, way north in the Upper Peninsula. He's the COO of Docs for Patient Care, the membership organization that helped spawn the Docs for Patient Care Foundation, and he's a fellow board member of the foundation. He's a former Navy surgeon, an assistant clinical professor at Michigan State, and someone who has a working knowledge of healthcare delivery across all platforms, private practice, academics, and military care. With few distractions in the Upper Peninsula, Dr. Armstrong has had the opportunity to read and learn and has become one of the leading experts regarding Medicare. So I thought we should pick his brain today and have him tell us things that you may not already know about Medicare. So it's with great pleasure that I invite you, Dick, into the Doctor's Lounge. Welcome in.
Good morning, Hal. And I guess I would make the comment that if I went into a doctor's lounge to talk about this subject, probably the rest of the people would leave.
You're absolutely
because
right.
Because Medicare is a complicated subject, and in fact, just in doing a little bit of research about this on the eHealth website, which is a private exchange website, eHealth did a recent survey of baby boomers and found that 77% of baby boomers, people that are getting ready or are already on Medicare, who should be rather well informed about this subject, don't know anything about it. So I thought maybe we could begin this morning by talking about what Medicare is, what the different parts of Medicare are, how they're financed, and what they pay for, so that the listeners could have a little bit better understanding of the basis of this whole thing.
Okay, so what is Medicare?
Well, Medicare, as you just mentioned, is the federal health insurance program that was passed in 1965 in the Johnson administration. And Medicare covers essentially everybody over 65, but also has some provisions to cover the disabled and people with end-stage renal disease. Those things were added during the Nixon administration in 1972. And Medicare is broken into four parts by the alphabet. Now, Part A is the one that most people are familiar with that covers inpatient hospitalization, hospice care, and some home health care. And that's the one that is funded by the payroll tax that we all pay, the 2.9% tax that is half paid by your employer and half paid by you. Now, some of this is going to change because of the Affordable Care Act, but basically that's what Part A is. Now, under Part A, people might wonder, you know, what do you have to do under Part A? And in order to understand that, I think that we need to make sure that people understand the definitions of a couple of things. One is deductible. For any insurance, the deductible is the amount you pay out of your pocket before the insurance company picks up the cost. And in Medicare Part A, for each benefit period, which can be kind of confusing, the deductible is $1,216. So that means that for Part A, you would have to pay $1,216 of, for instance, your hospital bill the first time you were admitted during that benefit period. And Medicare defines those benefit periods as the day you're admitted to the hospital up until the first 60 days of hospitalization. And then if you're discharged and you're out for a little while, another benefit period would begin. So there is some cost for Part A. And the other thing about Part A is that in order to be eligible for Part A, you have to have worked, and it doesn't have to be consecutive work, but you have to have worked in a job for at least 10 years where you pay the Medicare tax. And if you haven't done that, you can actually buy Part A, but it costs about $426 a month, and I don't think most people know that. So that's basically Part A. Did you have any comments about that, Hal?
No. I think that we'll just kind of run through some of the four parts, because I'd like to ask a few questions once you define it.
Okay. And Part B is the other part that covers physician services, outpatient hospital services, preventive care, and some home health services. And that's the one where people pay a premium. And actually, the premium for Part B is about $104.90 each month for most people, but it goes up depending upon your income. So wealthier people are paying a little bit more for Part B. And it should be noted, and we'll get into this, that the beneficiary premiums, in other words, the thing that people pay for Part B, this monthly premium, only covers 25% of Part B costs. Taxpayers pick up the remaining 75%. So this feeds into one of the problems in our budget, in that I think some people are under the impression that they've paid their premium in Medicare, and so when they go to get their benefits out, that is all paid for ahead of time, and they've paid it. But it turns out that Medicare only collects $1 for every $3 that it pays out. So you're really not paying in a prepaid health benefit.
So what does the average person pay in their lifetime for Medicare in a typical, you know, working career?
In typical working career, it depends on if you break it down into person or couple, but it's about between $106,000 to about 160,000, depending upon how long you work. An average person takes out between $350,000 and $380,000 in benefits.
Sounds like a great deal.
Yeah, that's a great deal. And I think that most people, you know, don't realize that, and a lot of people will stand up and say, well, I paid for my Medicare, so I should get the benefits, but it really doesn't work out that way, and that's one of the reasons that Medicare is in financial trouble, which we'll talk about a little bit later. Now, Medicare Part A and Part B are the original two parts of Medicare, and they are often referred to as traditional Medicare. So if you're reading something about Medicare, it usually will include information about A and B, and it'll be called traditional Medicare, or maybe it will be referred to as fee-for-service Medicare. And the reason that it's referred to as fee-for-service Medicare is it pays hospitals generally and physician and other providers generally based upon the service provided. So something is done, an operation, an office visit, an outpatient x-ray, something is done, and Medicare is billed and it gets paid. So there's a relationship between the amount of volume of services that are performed and the amount Medicare pays out. And that's also been a problem, and we can talk about that a little bit as we go on. So then we'll get into a little bit more controversial and complex parts of this. There is a Part C to Medicare, which originally began in 1982 as Medicare Plus Choice, but was kind of solidified in 1997 as part of the Balanced Budget Act, called Medicare Advantage. And Medicare Advantage plans were an attempt by the government, and still are, to bring in private insurance competition into the Medicare program. And patients, people, can opt out of being in Part A and Part B and decide that they would like the government to combine those two, pay a capitated amount of money to a private insurance company, and then buy a Medicare Advantage plan, which covers all of Part A and Part B, and then some other services that we'll talk about in a few minutes. Now, insurance companies compete to be in Medicare Advantage, but the difference is they generally have narrower physician networks, and they might have varying deductibles and varying copays depending upon what the patient purchases. It's a difficult subject to discuss because there's 3,400 types of options and plans in the country, and you know, the patients can choose depending upon what county they live in among a bunch of different options. So,
but that's a good thing, isn't there? There are choices.
There are choices, yes. There definitely are choices. But the controversy is involving the base payment that the government gives to these private insurance plans that has been set, what some people believe is a little too high, so that the Medicare Advantage plans have cost the government between 12% and 14% more over a period of time than they have in traditional Medicare.
And
it's like comparing apples and oranges, because people get more benefits for that buck.
That's what I was going to ask. Aren't they getting a higher level of care in a Medicare Advantage plan?
They are.
So really, the private sector is able to provide what the federal government won't.
Well, that's true, and as we move on in this discussion and we talk a little bit about what's necessary if you have traditional Medicare to supplement it, you'll get a feeling for where the money comes from for Medicare Advantage versus where the money comes from for what we'll talk about a little bit, and that would be Medigap plans.
Well,
go ahead.
I was going to say that, Dick, we're coming up to a hard break, and we've pretty much covered parts A, B, and C of Medicare.
Right.
And we'll just talk, and we'll explain part D and talk a little bit about the history in the next segment.
Okay, sounds good.
You're listening to America's Web Radio. This is Dr. Hal Schurz in the Doctor's Lounge.
Come on, follow Sniffles to Atlanta's go-to center for breathing easy. Do you suffer from chronic sinus headaches, recurrent sinusitis, facial pain or pressure, and chronic congestion? Well, balloon sinuplasty just could be the cure you're looking for.
Follow me and breathe easy.
Follow sniffles.com.
We treat the problem, not the symptom. Chronic sinus symptoms, gone. This could be the cure you're looking for.
Follow me and breathe easy.
This proven in-office procedure can have you breathing easy, back to work the next day, and it's done under local anesthesia. Get lasting relief, a quick recovery, and start breathing easy again.
Follow me and breathe easy.
Follow sniffles.com.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
Solution providers, are you aware of the Institute for Healthcare Consumerism's multiple marketing platforms? You're invited to get a little closer to IHC with our Solution Provider Membership Marketing Program. Through IHC's exclusive Solution Provider Membership, your business gets an all-access pass to engaging your prospects. This membership embeds your business within the Institute, which immediately aligns your company, its solutions, and your key executives with the nationally credible IHC brand, and shows your support of the healthcare consumerism movement as a market-wide solution. And that's just the beginning. Contact IHC's Managing Director, Brent Macy, today at bmacy@theihcc.com.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to the Doctor's Lounge. I'm here with my guest, Dick Armstrong, talking about Medicare. And so we've defined Parts A, B, and C. And Dick, why don't you quickly tell us about Part D Medicare?
Well, Part D is a prescription drug benefit program that was passed in 2003 in the Bush administration as part of the Medicare Modernization Act, and then it actually didn't go into effect until January of 2006. Basically, what it is it allows people that are in Medicare Part A and B to pick a plan to cover prescription drugs. But what people need to realize again is that it's a premium-supported program where the beneficiaries are paying a very small premium, average about $30 a month, for a very large benefit, and the taxpayers are picking up the rest of the cost. The interesting thing about Part D, and we'll get into this a little bit as we talk about reform, is that the program so far has come in 40% under the projected costs. So when people have to pay something, and they have to choose among plans where they actually have to think about paying something, they tend to be a little bit smarter about their purchases.
They're a little more discriminating when they've got skin in the game.
Exactly.
Did you
have any other comments or questions about these parts, Hal?
Not really. I think that that's probably one of the things that most people don't understand. They don't understand the four parts of Medicare. And so just to sum it up, Part A is the hospital segment. Part B is the physician segment, what pays for physician care and visits. Part C is the part that is involved with the private sector or the Medicare Advantage, and Part D is the prescription drug benefit plan.
That's right.
And this is always a political hot potato talking about all of this, but the history of Medicare, the desire to have the government involved in the payment of health care goes back a century, but it finally got off the ground under the Johnson administration, didn't it?
That's right. And actually, back in the 30s, after the Great Depression, when Franklin Roosevelt was grappling with the idea of Social Security, he strongly considered adding a health care benefit into the Social Security bill in 1935. But he was opposed by many people, and there were some people pushing him forward. And the interesting slight vignette about that is there's a famous neurosurgeon that we all know from Massachusetts General Hospital, Dr. Harvey Cushing, whose daughter Betsy was actually married to Franklin Roosevelt's son James. And Roosevelt was having a real dilemma trying to decide whether to push health care as part of the Social Security bill, and so he actually called Cushing to lunch. And Cushing was involved in organized medicine and the American Medical Association, who were at that time very much against this. And Cushing told Roosevelt that he would oppose this, and Roosevelt was concerned that if they added a Medicare-type benefit into Social Security in 1935, that the Social Security bill would not pass. So he made the decision to put it off in 1935.
It was actually Eleanor Roosevelt who was the influential one in that decision, wasn't it?
Well, she was also influential in that she had done some research on the status of hospitals in the United States at that time, and told her husband that they couldn't handle the volume of a new health care benefit, and it would create a chaotic situation.
So that didn't deter future presidents from trying to get into this?
No. Actually, World War II interrupted it a little bit. It kind of got put on the back burner, and then everybody knows that Harry Truman was in favor of it. But he had other things going on, rebuilding Europe and dealing with the Korean War. And Eisenhower made it very clear at the beginning of his two terms that he was not interested at all in any type of government-run healthcare program. So it really got put on the back burner until the campaign for the presidency in the late part of Eisenhower's second term. And interestingly, both John Kennedy and Richard Nixon were in favor of some type of government healthcare program, Kennedy more than Nixon. But the central figure in this that prevented it from happening until 1965 was a Democratic congressman from Arkansas, Wilbur Mills, who was the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee.
The man who dances in fountains.
That's right. But the interesting thing about Wilbur Mills before he was dancing in fountains was that he actually had a head for accounting. And he was in favor of the Social Security program, but he was very much against an open-ended health care program like Medicare, because he felt that the cost could never be controlled. And once the door was opened, it could never be shut again.
Boy, was he right.
Yes, he was very right. And he held it up. Because he was the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, he was able to hold up Medicare for a long time. At that time, he was in favor of a plan that he passed with Senator Kerr from New York called the Kerr-Mills Bill, which ended up becoming Medicaid. And this was just a block grant to states to help people that were poor pay for hospital services. And that was working and expanding as Medicare was being debated in the early 60s. Interestingly, back then, when 70% of doctors were members of the AMA, Dr. Edward Annis, who was then to be president of the AMA, spoke in Madison Square Garden against Medicare. It's on YouTube. If you look it up, Ed Annis, Madison Square Garden, you'll find it. And it's a very prescient talk about what's going to happen if we pass this Medicare law.
And what percentage of the doctors in this country are AMA members right now, Dick?
Less than 10% of actively practicing physicians are members of the AMA now.
That's unbelievable.
That is in no small... well, anyway, what I was going to say is that the reason is that the AMA doesn't generally represent the view of the majority of American physicians.
No, that's an entirely different conversation.
Right. So what happened to get Medicare passed, unfortunately, is that John Kennedy was assassinated. And he wanted Medicare badly, and Johnson agreed with him. So when Johnson won in a landslide in 1964, Wilbur Mills lost his majority in the House Ways and Means Committee. And actually, there was a famous phone call where Mills called Johnson and said, "Mr. President, I can count. In other words, I can't hold this up anymore." And so it went to the floor as the first two bills in 1965, H.R. 1 and S.1 and Medicare passed in 1965. Actually, it passed in a bipartisan manner because it was to honor the fallen president.
A little bit different than the passage of the Affordable Care Act.
Yes, a little bit different.
So,
but financially, not much different.
No.
Because the estimation of what it would cost to cover Medicare for the first few years up until 1990, at that point, the Johnson administration estimated it would cost $10 billion. And actually, by 1990, it had already cost $110 billion, just as Mills predicted.
So they were off by a factor of 10.
Yes, they were off by a factor of 10.
So they've predicted that the Affordable Care Act would cost about, well, initially it was in under $1 billion, right, at about at 900 million, but that those costs have quickly escalated. Now they're saying it's in the neighborhood of $2.7 trillion.
Right. Well, you may remember, and this is also a little bit different subject, that the president promised not to sign anything that cost one dime over $900 billion in the first decade.
That's right. So imagine if they're off by a factor of 10 with the Affordable Care Act at $2.7 trillion.
Well, there are many reasons that they're going to be off by more than a factor of 10. And, in fact, there are some people estimating now up to $4.8 trillion in the first decade.
That's just unbelievable. So let's get back onto Medicare. So this is a trivia question that that you may or may not know the answer to, but knowing you, I suspect you do. Who is the number one person in line who received the very first Medicare card?
Well, I do know the answer to that, and it's really kind of ironic. It was Harry Truman and his wife, Bess. And actually what happened is Lyndon Johnson flew to Independence, Missouri secretly to have a ceremony there at the library in Independence and to present these cards. And the reason I say that it's ironic is that Harry and Bess Truman were wealthy then, so they didn't need it, and they also never paid anything into it. So the first two cards were given to wealthy people who didn't contribute to the program, but it was it was like all these things are a political show at that time, and there's some famous pictures with Hubert Humphrey standing in the background and others. I should mention that there were many people. Johnson knew that the program was not fiscally sustainable, and he hid it from his own party, and he actually used Ted Kennedy to help hide it, who was a new senator from Massachusetts then. So they knew that this was not fiscally sustainable. And in fact, there was a conversation that's recorded, and you can get it from the Johnson Library, where on March 6, 1965, Hubert Humphrey in the Oval Office asks Johnson about the financing of Medicare and how he's worried about it. And LBJ answers him, and this is a quote, "Don't ever argue with me. I'll go $100 million or $1 billion on health care or education. I don't argue about that any more than I argue about Lady Bird buying flour. You got to have flour and coffee in your house and education and health. I'll spend the GD money. I may cut back some on tanks, but not on health."
Unbelievable. So this is really calculated right from the beginning.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So well, what about the money that people are paying into this Medicare trust fund, into the lockbox? Don't they just open up the lockbox and take the money out?
Well, no. Actually, the Medicare trust fund only applies to Part A, the hospital portion. And the Medicare trust fund, depending upon who you read and what numbers you look at, either from the actuary for Medicare or from the Congressional Budget Office, is either going to be completely depleted by about 2024 or 2028.
I think they just, in the Wall Street Journal this week, came out with a new CBO estimate saying that it was going to be extended till 2030. But even then, that's hardly a victory. We're talking about a system that is unsustainable, that's going broke. It's just a question of how quickly it goes broke. And the only way that they can prevent it from going entirely broke is to either continue to cut it or to make significant changes. And we're going to go ahead and explore those changes in the next segment of the show. This is Dr. Hal Schurz in the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
Certification. Do you know why becoming a certified healthcare consumerism specialist is more important than ever in 2014? Adding this specialized designation to your credentials tells employers or your clients that you understand how much our industry has changed and how to navigate that change successfully. IHC University's certification program offers coursework both online and live at their biannual forum conference series, and testing is completed online. Reaffirm your position as a leader in the health and benefit management industry. Download our certification overview and learn more at www.theihcc.com. That's www.theihcc.com.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
Watchdog is a term given an organization like the United States Justice Foundation, which since 1979 has been watching out and, when necessary, taking the appropriate action from testifying to litigating to protect our constitutional rights. USJF, a nonprofit organization, is nationally recognized not only as a watchdog, but many in the government, as well as those involved in legal cases, have also called the USJF a bulldog for the tenacious approach in their presentation and proof of what is right. Find out more at www.usjf.net. Support USJF as they support you.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Today in the Doctor's Lounge, we've been chatting about Medicare with my guest, Dr. Dick Armstrong, the COO of Docs for Patient Care. Our website is down for reconstruction, but it'll be back in operation next week at docs4patientcare.org. The foundation website, the foundation being the sponsor of the Doctor's Lounge, will also be operational in about 7 to 10 days, and then we can start to give you the information that we want you to have, so you'll get involved with helping to support the foundation. Excuse me. So, Dick, we were talking about the costs of Medicare, and the Medicare has been a linchpin in the discussions regarding the Affordable Care Act. How are the two connected?
Well, the two are connected in several ways, but actually the Affordable Care Act didn't do a whole lot to reform Medicare. It just, frankly, cut some money out of Medicare. But it's important for people to understand that both in the plan that the Republicans put forward, if you remember Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan's plans, and the Affordable Care Act, they actually just slow the growth of Medicare instead of slashing it and cutting it. And so essentially about $716 billion was mandated to be cut or reduced from Medicare in the Affordable Care Act from 2013 to 2022. And these, you would think that, okay, what they're going to do is maybe try to cut waste, fraud, and abuse and those kind of things, but these are across-the-board cuts. And the way that they do that is they put a hard cap on how much Medicare can grow starting in 2015 related to the GDP and a 1% factor above the GDP. And because of that fact, they think that reimbursement to physicians and to hospitals will be reduced to the point where they actually get down to about what Medicaid pays physicians and hospitals by 2020. And you can imagine for all of us who are involved in medical care that's devastating. It's not sustainable now for most people to take Medicaid. And if you cut Medicare down to the point where it's only paying what Medicaid is paying, it's going to be very difficult for people. In fact, they estimate that about 15% of hospitals will close by 2019, and if things continue, they think it'd be about 25% of hospitals by 2030 and 40% of hospitals by 2050 if Medicare stays on the trajectory that it's currently on.
So let's just inform our listeners about what you've just said. Medicare is a system which doctors get paid for providing health care to seniors, and they get paid a certain amount for doing so. And the amount that they get paid is a fraction of what their charges are. Doctors' charges aren't actually a realistic measure of what things cost anymore. But what they get reimbursed is really what I think is the important measure, because that's what determines how much a doctor makes and how well they can run their office, whether or not they can sustain an office and see patients.
Right, and right now, on average, Medicare pays about 80% of what most private health insurance plans pay.
And I think that the and that's not necessarily because the Medicare is reimbursing so well, but it's because that figure 80% is because insurance reimbursements are also going down.
That's true.
And so the amount that doctors can make seeing patients who are on Medicare has decreased considerably since the inception of Medicare.
Right, and as we mentioned earlier, the only way that physicians and, frankly, hospitals can make up for that is to by increasing the volume of what they do.
Or by offsetting those costs against patients whose care doctors are being paid more to provide.
Well, right, and by increasing the volume, it'll just take a family practice office, for instance. Right now, because of the fact that the only way that a family practitioner can make enough to keep up with his overhead would be to increase the volume, the average time for a family practice office visit in the United States now is 8 minutes.
So what I'm getting to is the fact that because Medicare reimbursement has really plummeted, and also because the regulations, the federal oversight and regulations that involve seeing patients who are on Medicare, and the risks to physicians for providing it, the threat of having the government come back and audit your charts and take back money that they have paid you without any recourse to doctors. There are a lot of factors that have soured doctors on participating in Medicare, so they've been dropping off in record numbers.
Exactly. And, of course, that affects seniors' access to physicians.
So there are a lot of places, Dick, where seniors are unable to find a doctor today. Isn't that true?
That's true. And that's getting worse, and we talk about that all the time among our physician colleagues. It's no wonder. You can't keep an office open if it costs you more to see a patient than you're getting reimbursed to see them.
So there are two ways that this can be addressed, and one way is a very onerous, very bad way as far as you and I are concerned, and that is that there have been discussions in Washington about trying to nationalize physicians' licenses to compel them to see Medicare patients. Otherwise, there's nobody left to take care of the seniors.
Well, right, and as you know, that's been attempted a couple times in Massachusetts, and it's failed to pass. And hopefully, as people are more and more educated, including our colleagues, that would fail to pass anywhere because it's really, for lack of a better word, indentured servitude. I mean, you're then forced in your profession to provide care for little or no reimbursement, which is just ridiculous.
So the second way is to fix the system.
Mm-hmm.
How do we do that, Dick?
Well, there are many proposals, and what's really interesting historically and true now today is that the fix was investigated back beginning in 1997 when the Balanced Budget Act was passed during Clinton's administration. There was a commission on the future of Medicare, which was chaired by Senator Breaux, and he's a Democrat, and Senator Thomas, a Republican, and they gave their report to Congress in 1999 and recommended that Medicare be converted to what's called a premium support program. And it's a little bit complicated to explain, but essentially, this program exists already for employees of the federal government who are under the Federal Employees Health Benefit Program that is run by the office, Office of Personnel Management in the federal government. And what it is it's interestingly, it's a highly regulated exchange where private insurance plans compete for bids to be allowed to sell policies to people in the federal government. And in a premium support plan, private insurance plans would have bids to sell policies to Medicare beneficiaries.
Why can that exchange work so well in what we're seeing right now under Obamacare? Why is that failing miserably?
Well, that's a complex question, and I guess what I would have to say is if you look at the federal health benefits program in the private program in for federal employees, it's worked extremely well for about three decades. It's because of the way that it's designed, frankly, and the way that it works to reduce the amount of money that Medicare has to pay, and the way that it works to get Medicare back on a fiscal balance, which would take several decades, is that wealthy people pay more for their plans, and the government gives less support to them, and lower income people pay less out of pocket for their plans, and the government gives them more support. Some call this means testing. There's other ways to put that, and it's very difficult. It's a political hot potato to talk about those things. But it would have to be, we all know that it would have to be gradually instituted, and that's why when it was talked about in the 2012 campaign, the Ryan budget and the Ryan plan, so that it wouldn't start for people until they were, all the people under 55 would go into this program at 65, but everybody 55 to 65 currently would stay in current Medicare. The other important thing about all the premium support programs is traditional Medicare would still remain in there as an option. So if people wanted to stay in traditional Medicare, they could, which kind of silences some of the opposition from the other side. And it would gradually, over time, allow patients to choose the plans that they need, market forces to come in, and a balance to occur, but it would take several decades. I think it was estimated in Ryan's plan that we wouldn't really get to balance until about 2070.
But it would sustain it.
Yes, it would sustain it.
And that's what seniors are deathly afraid of. They're afraid that they're hearing conflicting reports about Medicare running out of money, and other people are trying to reassure them, no, we can just stay on the path we're on, and everything is going to be okay. We'll just keep printing more money and bolster it up.
Well, the proponents for not doing premium support, basically their argument is, okay, we've already had some reforms that are available in the Affordable Care Act. Let's let them play out and see how that works. But, you know, most of the people that look at this, including the Medicare actuaries, for the reasons that we just talked about, don't believe that Congress will allow those things to happen. We haven't talked about the SGR or the doc fix here, but basically the public will not allow the Congress to allow Medicare reimbursement rates or the benefits to seniors to be reduced to the point where a lot of, quote, suffering occurs. And so there'll be great pressure for none of these things that are projected to occur. And so the spending will just increase, you know, back to what Congressman Wilbur Mills predicted. You open the door and it can't be shut.
Wow. Well, you know, we're coming up to a hard break, and then we'll be in our last segment. So we'll talk a little bit about fixing this problem that we have with Medicare and trying to come up with some answers. This is the Doctor's Lounge. You're listening to America's Web Radio.
This is Dr. Susan Blank, Medical Director for the Atlanta Healing Center. Our team is able to offer a multitude of treatment options, such as quantitative EEG, also known as brain mapping, hormonal and nutritional assessments, neuropsychological testing, and cognitive therapy, along with traditional 12-step facilitation. And we can even offer you, if appropriate, a gentle medically managed detox. Please contact us at 770-696-9862.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
Watchdog is a term given an organization like the United States Justice Foundation, which since 1979 has been watching out and, when necessary, taking the appropriate action, from testifying to litigating to protect our constitutional rights. USJF, a nonprofit organization, is nationally recognized not only as a watchdog, but many in the government, as well as those involved in legal cases, have also called the USJF a bulldog for the tenacious approach in their presentation and proof of what is right. Find out more at www.usjf.net. Support USJF as they support you.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back into the Doctor's Lounge. Our guest today, Dr. Dick Armstrong, has helped us all to understand the Medicare problem a bit more than we did before. And in this last segment, we'll just wrap it up and we'll talk about some more ways to fix the Medicare mess. Dick, we didn't really talk about the Affordable Care Act very much and what it means to Medicare. You know, one of the things that you and I speak about all around the country is the effect on seniors, what it's going to mean in terms of covert rationing of care. Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. There are a couple of things that are, well, actually about three things that are put into the Affordable Care Act that are supposed to help control costs. And one of these that we've talked about a lot over the years is a thing called accountable care organizations. A big word, and it sounds complicated, but basically what it does is that a group of doctors, they can either be private or working with a hospital, are given a certain amount of money to take care of a minimum of 5,000 people in the Medicare population. And if these doctors are able to take care of these people over a period of time and spend less money taking care of them than Medicare paid them, then the doctors can keep that money as a bonus and put it in their pocket. So what that does is that it puts your doctor in a position where he makes or she makes a bonus by denying you care. And it's that's as straightforward as I can put it. And mm-hmm. so what it does is it makes your doctor into a rationer for their own financial benefit, which is really, I believe, personally unethical.
Well, not necessarily even their personal benefit, for the benefit of their employer.
Well, right, and to their personal benefit, too, because they do get a bonus as part of this
program. No question, but many of them get pressured.
Correct.
And their job depends on it.
Right. So for instance, you know, if you have back pain and your doctor thinks you need an MRI, somewhere in the back of the brain, the doctor's thinking, but the MRI is expensive, and if I just we do a little bit of physical therapy or use some medications and some bed rest, maybe we can get by without doing the imaging. And so it puts a wedge between the physician and the patient with regard to what's best for the patient and not necessarily doing what's best economically.
Okay. The second thing.
What's Go ahead.
There's another
set of bureaucratic things called the patient-centered medical home. And this gets a little more complicated, but it's supposed to be making your physician's office into a super primary care office, which is really a throwback to what doctors that did primary care used to do many years ago, and that is they took care of everything for you. The problem with it is that it involves all kinds of reporting, bureaucratic hoops to jump through, and it ends up being more expensive to provide care than under a regular system of just doing primary care without all the bureaucratic hoops. There's a lot of details to it, and we actually, in my practice, we are a patient-centered medical home, and I have a lady that sits next to me in another office who is the head of that, and she sees both sides of it, but, you know, she we're not doing any different or anything different than we did 3 years ago, but we have her sitting in the office next to me getting a salary, which is paid by the taxpayers, sure, to be this patient-centered medical home. And, of course, she likes her job.
Right.
And she comes up with all these wonderful statistics, and we all look at them and say, well, that's interesting, but it's no different than what we did 3 years ago. You're just telling us we're doing a good job, and we did before.
Right. So basically what this is, it's a way to further delay treatment.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In some cases. Now, of course, not in all cases. I mean, if you're trying to be a patient-centered medical home and you're in a practice that was poorly organized, you might find some benefit, following your diabetics or hypertensives or something, and you might be able to say, well, gee, I think we're doing better. But you would hope that doctors would know to do that without having the government step in and say, you have to do this.
Right. And then there's a third way that ration care will occur in Medicare, right? That's the over-regulation of some of the 159 new agencies that were created.
Well, and then there's another specific thing that we haven't mentioned yet called the Independent Payment Advisory Board, which is out there looming and hasn't been appointed yet. This is a 15-member board of medical bureaucrats that are unaccountable, actually. And what they're tasked with is to make sure that they make recommendations to Congress that have to be instituted to keep this hard cap on Medicare spending, this 1% above GDP, starting in 2015, but actually they're early. The time that they may make a recommendation would be in 2016, according to the budget numbers. But they can only really do this by cutting payments to hospitals and physicians. And they'll do that by telling hospitals and physicians what Medicare will or will not pay for based upon recommendations from other panels within the that you just mentioned within the ACA.
Mm. So I get asked this question quite frequently at many of the events that I speak at, and I know you do as well. Seniors seem to be the most informed group of healthcare consumers and the most worried. They wonder, what can they do? Tell us, is there hope for the Medicare, and what can seniors do?
Well, I think that the most important thing is that they need to become informed so that they actually know what they're talking about, and that's a little bit about what we're doing right now today. Medicare is a very complex issue, and one of the things that that President Obama said when he was trying to convince everyone that what he was doing in the ACA for Medicare was right is he would get out and say, I'm strengthening Medicare. Well, what that translated into was the cuts that I'm making in Medicare over the next decade are going to push out the insolvency year to another 5 to 8 years, and that is translated into strengthening. But if you just listen to I'm strengthening, maybe you'll sit back in your easy chair and think, oh, good, the president's going to help Medicare. But then you see the actual details of how that occurs. And the way I refer to it sometimes that people don't like is that it was a stealth way to convince people that we have to cut Medicare. Because everybody in the Congress, everybody, and we've talked about this directly with Senator Coburn in his office, everybody knows in Washington that this isn't a budget problem. Everybody knows that they have to do something about it, but nobody has the courage to actually attempt it. You may remember that President Reagan tried to do this in 1987. He tried to add a benefit to Medicare, a drug benefit and a catastrophic care benefit, and they passed it, bipartisan passed it, and Dan Rostenkowski from Chicago was the lead person to help pass it. But they didn't tell seniors up front that they were going to have to pay an increased premium in order to get these benefits. And when they found out that their premiums were going up by about $800 a year, they revolted. And the whole thing was repealed within a year.
Mm.
So those of us who believe that the Affordable Care Act didn't solve the problem can take some solace in the fact that when the public finally finds out what they've got, that they will do the same thing.
Okay, well, we hope that will happen this November at the ballot boxes, and I hope that people will become more informed. And I agree, that's what we're trying to do on this show and what doctors who are plugged in are trying to do all over the country like you do, Dick. So I want to thank you for being with me. It was a great discussion, and thanks for taking time to share your wealth of knowledge about Medicare with our listeners here in the Doctor's Lounge.
Thanks a lot, Hal.
If you've enjoyed some of the topics that we've been discussing in the Doctor's Lounge, then you would love to be part of what we're going to be doing live when we sponsor a healthcare forum as part of the Steamboat Institute annual conference in Steamboat Springs, Colorado on August 22nd to 23rd. There are some seats that are still left, but they're going fast in this very intimate and incredible conference that we've been privileged to be a part of for the last 5 years. The keynote speaker there is going to be Ben Carson, who most of you who are listening know. He's a tremendous leader, an outspoken physician who has taken some very controversial stands, and he believes in what's good about the country and healthcare, and we're so honored to have him there. So be part of this exciting event. For more information, go to their website at www.steamboatinstitute.org. You can listen to the show and all of our past shows by going to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio website. All of the shows are archived, and please circulate them to your friends and to your social media contacts. We'd love to hear from you with comments about our show. Tell us about topics that you might want to hear us discuss, or comments about the shows that we've already had. You can email us at doctorslounge@americaswebradio.com. Once again, doctorslounge@americaswebradio.com. I'd like to once again thank David Moxley, the brains and muscle behind America's Web Radio, who's been my engineer today. I'll be back with you in 2 weeks when my guest will be Dr. Jeffrey English, the co-director of the MS Center of Atlanta, as we discuss hospital consolidations, which is occurring as a side effect or as a result of Obamacare, and what it means to you, the healthcare consumer, with regard to getting the kind of healthcare that you need. This is Dr. Hal Scherzen. Until next time, stay healthy and stay informed.
This is America's Web Radio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.